I want to thank all the labor unions here in Dane County that help keep Sly'sOffice.com up and going so you keep up to date, whether it be the Madison Firefighters, Local 311, or the Madison Teamsters, Local 695, or our friends at Madison Teachers Incorporated. These are some of the most active local unions who organize, and constantly stand up for workers. Thank you from Sly'sOffice.com.
Welcome to another podcast brought to you by the United Steelworkers at Sly'sOffice.com. Joining us now, Scott Paul from the Alliance for American Manufacturing. Scott, welcome to the show.
Hey, Sly. It is always really great to be with you.
Quite a contrast between media coverage of NAFTA negotiations in Canada versus the United States. It is absolutely being ignored for the most part in America. While there is a fair amount of coverage in Canada, although I will say the Canadian media is shallow on the issue as the American media. They seem to just think that these things like NAFTA are a verb. You know, that it's trade, right? That's as deep as it goes.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a... Well, look, I don't know that trade policy has ever been one to awaken the masses with all the acronyms and the sections and all of that, because, I mean, the truth is a lot of this stuff is very complicated, and, you know, there are a lot of products and services and a lot of implications to doing trade right. But I think that there are a couple of things that have emerged from the NAFTA renegotiations, which are... kind of paused, but are going to start again in a couple of weeks and see if they can reboot a little bit. And that is that, you know, something that I think I have known from all along is that, yeah, NAFTA has been a raw deal. It's been terrible for the United States. It's been particularly bad for workers in industries like auto parts that have a lot of exposure to low-wage competition in Mexico. And it's an agreement that has put corporate rights at the very top and really hasn't done anything whatsoever to address the race to the bottom with respect to labor. And the United States has given away a lot of stuff in NAFTA. And so kind of taking that back is not an easy thing to do. And, you know, so you have the U.S. Trade Ambassador Bob Lighthizer saying, essentially, yeah, we're not going to make any concessions. This has been a bad deal. We want to take all of this back from Canada and Mexico, and not surprisingly, since they represent governments that are elected by the people, the negotiators from Mexico and Canada have said, not so fast. and so it's going to be a kind of a chess game moving forward on how this gets done. I think I always knew it would never be easy. I do think that there is a path forward to do it, but I mean the other.
Well, are we on the right path?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. I mean, there hasn't been a lot of transparency with respect to the negotiation. I'm not clear when President Trump says we're going to get a better deal. A better deal for whom? For workers? And if so, what are we going to do on labor rights? And so I think there are a lot of questions. I ultimately don't think, and this is intuition, this is not inside information, but I ultimately think that the U.S. is not going to completely withdraw from NAFTA without some sort of a substitute in place, because there are these supply chains, these facts on the ground, they can be changed over time, but it just seems really unlikely to me that you'd want to do something that would cause a real disruption. And honestly, it would hurt some American workers too. And I think this is something that the steelworkers and other trade unionists know as well. And so trying to navigate through these very treacherous waters, I mean, that's kind of the goal. And we're doing the best that we can under these circumstances.
Let me ask you, so and when it comes to some of the content rules, there have been some Canadian unions complaining that America changing some of the content rules could actually result in more cars being made in Mexico. I don't really understand that. How complicated is this? And are there unintended consequences of getting rid of some of the bad parts of NAFTA that could backfire?
It's a great question. So it's the content rules are super complicated.
Probably deliberately so.
Yeah, probably deliberately so. But right now, basically, a car to get NAFTA treatment, that is tariff-free treatment within the three countries, has to be 62.5% made in the United States, Mexico, and Canada. And there are certain assumptions that are made into that. And so the question is, do you raise that? Do you raise that up? And that's something that the Trump administration says it's want to do. That's something that I support. I think it's a good idea to raise that content threshold. I also think it's a good idea to just not assume that certain things are made in North America and not really trace them. So, like, steel is a great example of this. And when NAFTA was negotiated in 1994, there really wasn't competition from China when it came to steel, and now half of the world's steel is made in China, and so that has changed. And so there is a way to do this that's not going to mean that more of the cars are going to be made in Mexico, but I think it takes more than just taking the content rules or getting rid of some of the assumption about where the steel is produced. I think it also means having high standards so that imports coming into the market, particularly from countries like Japan or Korea and potentially one day China, are held to a reasonable standard. That is, they don't have an advantage based on currency manipulation or workers' rights, or externalizing pollution costs, or government support.
I love that term, externalizing pollution costs. In other words,
I'm doing my best to sound like an economist there, Sly.
In other words, making it in a country with low standards and the pollution be damned, right?
That's exactly right.
Although, I don't know, yeah. After this EPA that we have now, maybe we could be that country, right?
We may be such a... Well, and it was interesting. I think one of the Canadian proposals was to say that right-to-work laws would be violations of NAFTA, basically.
I love that they brought that up.
Yeah. So it's needless to say, with all that on the table, and we've only touched a couple of the issues, there's a lot that they have to work through. I will say, I've worked with Bob Lighthizer in the past, who is the U.S. trade ambassador. He's a tough negotiator. He knows how to do this. And I will also say that there have been many times...
Nobody's working for a crazy man.
Yeah. Hopefully he's just focused on the task at hand, Sly, but it's hard not to see all that other stuff going on. It's really hard. But we haven't had a trade negotiator for a long time who's been willing to get up from the table and walk away. I mean, I remember back in the early years of the Reagan era, the late years of the Carter administration, with Japan, that's what our negotiators did to make a point. And even in Canada, Chrystia Freeland did that with the Europeans a couple years ago. She just got up, walked away from the table, and said, "We're not going to get a deal if you guys are insist on this." And eventually, they came back and they got a deal. And so, I do think that I think that we'll see some hardball tactics like that. I don't know how effective they'll be in this environment, but that's just kind of, that's where we are. It's something that we're tracking closely. There's a lot at stake. There's a lot of trade between the three countries. At the end of the day, we want to make sure there are, number one, more job opportunities, and number two, that the rights and prospects for workers in all three countries are elevated, because it is not, Mexican workers taking the jobs away from Americans. It's the rules that these companies are allowed to operate under that make that possible.
Well, and there's unfortunately, it wasn't discussed during the campaign. And whenever we have immigration debates, I always say that we're kind of missing the big picture. Why are so many people wanting to leave Central America, South America, and Mexico? And clearly these trade agreements have exacerbated that, but nobody ever wants to go back to the root cause.
That's right. Yeah, which is economic Initially, it was political instability, you know, in the 1980s and violence. And a lot of it is economic, and they've reinforced each other, and it is I think that's a challenge, and there are, you know, in the 20 some years of NAFTA that we've had, you know, have workers' rights in Mexico improved at all? Can they form independent unions? Do they have any leverage when they're collective bargaining? And I think the answer to that not only is no. But things aren't better in the United States, right? I mean, compared to where they were 20-some years ago. They're a lot worse. And so it's not like a trade agreement is going to fix this. But at the very least, Sly, it shouldn't make it worse.
When you see stories like former Georgia governor and now Agriculture Secretary Sonny Perdue holding up that map for the president. You know, here's how red states will be negatively affected if you change NAFTA, that sort of thing. How do you respond to that?
Yeah, it's interesting because the agricultural situation is complex. We do a lot of agricultural trade with Mexico and Canada. There is no question about that. And I know that in your neck of the woods, these are important issues as well. And so
we used to have 150,000 dairy farms in the state. I don't know what's down to 15,000. You know,
and there are serious issues with Canada with respect to dairy trade and kind of leveling the playing field and how open their market is. And so it is complex. But yeah, Sonny Perdue is using broad brush strokes to say, look, we export a lot of grain to Mexico, it's going to, you know, all these farmers are going to be upset. I mean, the reality is that, I mean, we do have a comparative advantage in agricultural production because it's a lot of it in the United States is large scale and corporate and somewhat, although I will say legally, but somewhat under the trade rules, is subsidized. And I don't know that changing NAFTA is going to change those trade flows so much. I mean, it's a scare tactic, but where we have been really hurt is in the automotive sector and in the auto parts sector in particular, the kind of the second and third tier suppliers. And I, you know, we've discussed this before. I was raised in northern Indiana, and it is now, there are small towns that are littered with abandoned factories that have weeds growing up in the parking lot.
It's not just big
cities. Used to make auto parts. Yeah. Yeah. Used to make auto parts and are now down in Mexico.
And, of course, we're not just talking about NAFTA affecting that. We know from Freeport, Illinois and Sensata that there's the China component.
Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly right. China directly and indirectly has had an impact on that. And one of the things that I'm hoping that we can do through NAFTA is make it a much more competitive model for competition between all three countries and China. But the way to do that is not to pursue the race to the bottom. It's to, you know, get Canada and Mexico to join the United States in insisting that China honor the rules of global trade. I mean, that's a big, big part of it. And figuring out a NAFTA that's going to boost incomes and wages in all three countries so that we have more consumers here. And it goes back to what Roosevelt said in the 1930s, which was, you know, the best customer for business is a well-paid American worker.
Well, amen to that.
They're going to buy stuff.
History is replete with presidents that used to make pro-labor comments, including some Republican ones, Abraham Lincoln and Dwight Eisenhower. By the way, if I were ever president, I'd have a tough time deciding who would be my trade representative. Would it be Lori Wallach or would it be Scott Paul?
I'd pick Lori. That would Lori is Lori's tough and she knows the law front and back. I mean, I can do the PR, but we'll let her do the negotiating.
Okay. All right. Stand by. We'll talk more with Scott Paul from the Alliance for American Manufacturing at SliceOffice.com. Brought to you by the United Steelworkers.
Injury lawyers Mike Riley and John Walsh.
When you hire a lawyer to help you with your personal injury, you want to know that you'll have that lawyer's personal attention. With John and I, that's exactly what you'll get. With many firms, the lawyer that you see in the ad is not the lawyer who is going to be representing you in the case.
One of the differences with Mike and my practice is that when you hire us, you'll have us personally involved in your case.
Call injury lawyers Mike Riley and John Walsh at 257-5661 for the personal attention you deserve.
Welcome back to SliceOffice.com, brought to you by the United Steelworkers and great local unions like Madison Firefighters Local 311, Teamsters 695, and of course, our friends at Madison Teachers Incorporated. Scott Paul, the Alliance for American Manufacturing, they're a coalition of labor and business groups that actually support things being made in America while workers are paid well and work in safe environments. The president's going to Asia. There's a lot that's been going on, and there's a lot that's been neglected. He made a lot of promises that, you know, manufacturing was going to come back to America. What has he failed to do since he took office in January?
Yeah, well, he hasn't failed to tweet, so he's held up that end of the bargain.
Yeah,
unfortunately, that's weak of Brzezinski. Don't bring jobs back,
right?
Yeah. So there's a big gap between what he said he would do and what he's actually done. I mean, you know, we've discussed this before. He withdrew from the Trans-Pacific Partnership. It was already dead as a doornail, and so that wasn't a particular act of courage.
You say it was dead because Congress wasn't going to.
Yeah, Congress wasn't going to pass it. It had virtually no Democratic support. The final four presidential candidates all said that they opposed it, and so it wasn't. So that wasn't something that Trump, in and of himself, got done. I mean, that was laid out for him by others who had been fighting this. And you mentioned Lori Wallach being one of them, and the labor movement. So I don't even know how much credit Trump deserves for that. The other thing that he has just done, and I do think this is important, is maintain what is called China's non-market economy status. It means that if China's dumping into the United States, we can put higher tariffs on than if they were considered to be a market economy. And you just know from both reading the headlines and looking at the data that China is not a market economy. It's a state-run economy. It's run by the Chinese government, and it continues to be doing so. And so he has done that, but what hasn't he done? He did not name China as a currency manipulator, which he said he would do. He hasn't done that on two occasions now.
He used that as an excuse for kind of the carrot and the stick in dealing with North Korea. But how did that work out?
Yeah, not particularly well. And it allows, I mean, the problem with that slide, too, when you make it kind of a quid pro quo, is that China's going to game him, right? I mean, every time that that we need something on North Korea, they will, you know, they'll pause and wait and find a hook like this currency manipulation or some other trade matter and say, well, if you go soft on us here, we'll give you some help. And he's kind of set this in dynamic up, and that's something that he criticized. You know, he's like the forgotten man in Rome. We got to put them first. They shouldn't be pawns of diplomacy. And he's doing exactly that. He's started all sorts of investigations on steel and aluminum, and in particular the impact of imports from China on steel and aluminum and how they impact national security and intellectual property. But none of those cases have come to a closure yet, and it's having an impact on steel mills in the United States. There have been layoffs in Pennsylvania. There will be likely more layoffs because you have steel imports that are now rising. They're up by 20% over last year. And so instead of making the situation better for steel workers in the steel industry in the United States, in many ways he's made it worse by you know, coming out of the gates, sounding real tough, signing a flurry of executive orders, and then literally doing nothing. So it's been a problem. And our trade deficit is up year over year with China. And so by any measure you want to look at, you know, he's not both performance and delivering on the things he said he was going to do, he's fallen short.
What could he be doing?
Well, he could wrap up this negotiation on steel in particular, it's in his own power. He doesn't need Congress to do that. He could sign an order tomorrow that would say, you know, until our industry stabilizes, we will have tariffs on imported steel. He can exempt countries from that, particular countries, if he thinks that, you know, if we want to leave out Canada and Mexico, for instance. But he could do that tomorrow. It's within his power to do that, and he refuses to do that. He could have named China as a currency manipulator. It's perfectly within his power to do that. It's something he said he was going to do, and he completely failed to do that. And so, Sly, it's not like you can blame. I get tweets all the time that are like, "Oh, you're hard on Trump. You know, Congress is what's standing in the way." And I'm like, that's BS. They're not standing in the way. These are things that Donald Trump could sign something and get it done tomorrow if he wanted to do that. But China's playing him. There are fierce debates within the administration, and it looks like the banking Wall Street wing has kind of won this argument.
Shocking. Well, we know after he signed the. Or is going to sign the legislation protecting the banks against class action suits. That there is that wing in the party. So who wing within his administration? So who are the two forces in the administration? Who are the people that would like him to step up on this stuff in his administration? And I think I know who the other ones are.
Yeah, so, you know, you have, so I mentioned Bob Lighthizer, who's the U.S. Trade Ambassador. I have a lot of respect for him. I know that he's going to work hard to try to get better outcomes on trade policy. Wilbur Ross, who's the Commerce Secretary, of the billionaires in the cabinet, he's probably the best one.
as an employer, he saved some factories in America, right?
He sure did. Yeah, he sure did. And I think, again,
he's got some other problems that might
be. Well, yeah, he has a lot of holdings. And I know people have raised questions about those, but I mean, knowing, you know, his thinking on American manufacturing, he's going to want to help it. I'm not going to pretend like he's a friend of the factory worker, right? I mean, he's a billionaire, but he wants to see manufacturing grow in the United States. And then you have Peter Navarro, who was the academic who joined the Trump campaign as an advisor. He has also written for us on China trade policy in the past, and he is at the Office of Manufacturing and Trade Policy, which has now been swallowed up by the National Economic Council, which is run by Gary Cohn, Goldman Sachs. So Peter's still there, and he's advocating on this, and that's just about it. I mean, Steve Bannon, when he was within the administration, he happened to hold the view on trade, he combined that with immigration and a lot of nativism. But I think that he viewed it much as a political tool to try to divide traditional Democratic Party constituencies
Crudest sense, that if Donald Trump were to build a different political coalition that was sort of separate from the old one, he would need to get Indiana, Wisconsin, Michigan, Ohio off life support when it comes to manufacturing, right? I mean, he would really need to make some permanent changes where. There's a lot of people that voted for Trump because they wanted to see some different results. They kind of thought that maybe Clinton was going to carry on with the previous three administrations when it comes to trade policy. If this doesn't change, I think people are going to hold Trump accountable.
Look, I maybe when it's election time, they will. Having spent some time with Trump voters in industrial states, mm-hmm. I think they still kind of view him as a disruptor, and that Congress is still the problem or the swamp is still the problem. But I think you're also right, Sly. I think that at the end of the day, if he hasn't delivered on this trade agenda, it's going to be pretty clear, and he's not going to be able to blame Congress. I mean, you know, there's a lot of this. This is the one thing that, and I know Lori Wallach would agree as well, where Trump has wide leeway to make a lot of changes and doesn't need that doesn't need to get anything through Congress, which is particularly difficult. So I, you know, it is in his own hands, and I, you know, a year from now, and certainly 3 years from now, if he hasn't delivered, look, there's likely to be more consequences. There are, but I, you know, the you know, a lot of the folks who voted for Trump voted both for change or anger at the status quo, and they're you know, many of them I think are still rooting for him, but it's also, I think it's very fair to say that he hasn't delivered, and I get, you know, I get called all sorts of names on social media for pointing that out, and then I kind of run through the facts, and you know, someone will blame Congress, and I'll say, look, this is him. This is all about him, and the argument kind of peters out. And so it's, but you're right. It ultimately, I think that he does have to match his rhetoric and his campaign promises on this. And in this particular instance, when it comes to trade policy, I want to see him succeed.
You know, has there been a change, because there's such a visceral reaction to Donald Trump among Democrats? Are you concerned at all that some of the opposition to these trade agreements among Democrats has, I don't mean Democratic politicians, but in some cases voters, has slipped away because they're kind of tying the rest of Trump's agenda to his remarks on trade?
Sly, that is a remarkable insight, and it's something that I've been thinking a lot about. And you're right. I mean, polling shows that support for trade agreements or for free trade has risen among Democrats since Trump's election. And part of it is that they, you know, a lot of people who don't tune in every day, you know, think that he is for something, so they want to be on the other side of it. Now, where this, you know, where the rubber hits the road on this is like, what do the office holders, what do the actual folks who are running for office as well think about this? And when you look at, like, Chuck Schumer has called Trump a weakling on trade, and, you know, all hat, no cattle. And so, you know, Democratic leaders are tacking to a more aggressive stance on trade than Trump so far has carried out. And I think that serves them well, but I, you know, they're, at the same time, there are hundreds of new candidates who are running for office who, you joined because of the resistance, and all of us who care about these manufacturing issues and these trade issues, we have a lot of work to do.
I haven't seen any sign that there's a bunch of pro-free trade Democrats running. I have not seen any indication of that, so it kind of seems like this is a little surfacey, but it does concern me. And it also concerns me that there's going to be a lot of people pushing to have a permanent realignment where Democrats just go for, you know, a wealthier group of people, that an educated group of people, and we kind of forget the blue collar people. And by the way, you know, I think one of the horrible misreadings of all this is, when we're talking about people that work in manufacturing, that we're just talking about white guys.
Right.
You know, if you know anything about Milwaukee, the Wall Street Journal called it the star of the snow belt in the early 1970s because so many African Americans had good paying jobs. And the 30th Street corridor has been decimated. It is not just white people that have been decimated by these trade policies.
No, in many ways, African American communities were hit harder, sooner, and it's been longer lasting effects, in part because of other discriminatory policies, and they've had it worse in a lot of ways, and that's flown completely under the radar. But I just, you know, I think that there is a vigorous debate about, like, how to reform, or do we need to reform a Democratic coalition, and excluding kind of the working class, or the white working class in particular, would be a lethal mistake, because we would win the heck out of New York and Chicago and Los Angeles and all the urban centers of the United States and just get completely obliterated everywhere else. And as you know, if you count the Electoral College math, that doesn't work particularly well. And I think that you have to have a competitive message that's going to appeal to those voters. And I will, you know, we can have a debate about this if you want to, Sly, but I think, you know, when you looked at Obama in 2012, you know, he ran on manufacturing for re-election. I mean, did he deliver on it? Nah, you know, no, he didn't. But he promised 1 million new manufacturing jobs. He ran on a Made in America message and said he was going to get tough and all of this. And it worked for him. And in a different way, it obviously worked for Trump. So, you know, there's something there that folks ought to pay attention to.
Scott Paul from the Alliance for American Manufacturing, thanks for coming to Sly's office today.
You bet. It's been a pleasure, Sly.
Slysoffice.com, brought to you by the United Steelworkers.
Slysoffice.com.
Thanks a million.
Bye-bye.
Making stuff matters, because when we make things in America, America makes it. American workers and families make it. Our communities make it. Consider this. For every one manufacturing job in our communities, 5 more jobs are supported. Manufacturing jobs pay an average of 10 to 50% more than service sector jobs. That allows working families to support their local businesses, schools, emergency services, and more. Creating 2.5 million new manufacturing jobs would mean at least $100 billion for our economy over the next decade. Domestic manufacturing is the green economy. It's among the cleanest, most efficient, and productive in the world. That's why the United Steelworkers and our more than 1 million members and retirees are fighting so hard to protect and grow manufacturing. Because making stuff really does matter. Join our fight. Visit usw.org and like us at facebook.com/steelworkers. Support American manufacturing. Buy American. Buy Union.